This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And you don't know it, but you're the mark. Everyone is showering you with love. They're kind of whittling down your defenses and starting to make you more and more dependent on feeling part of that group. Once they get you isolated for a long time, they start layering in the theology, which eventually kind of ends with, oh, by the way, Reverend Moon is the Messiah. Would you like to join?
It's finally here, my long-awaited episode with Elgin Strait, who grew up in the Moonies cult, also known as the Unification Church, run by Sun Myung Moon, a Korean man who claimed to be a kind of messiah. The Moonies exploded into the mainstream in the 1970s due to the exposure of its mass weddings. These enormous wedding ceremonies were a key tenet to the Moonies' belief system because Moon claimed that only by marrying one another could they procreate and produce pure children. It's all a bit Harry Potter, and therefore be made pure themselves. This led to all sorts of child transporting or trafficking between families, particularly when one wasn't able to conceive, leaving many children feeling bewildered and unsure of their place. And it's all very sad, really. As Elgin alludes to in the episode, it led to a sensation of being a commodity, because the belief was that having or adopting a child was the only way to get into heaven. So you felt a bit used, like you were the ticket for them to get to heaven. I had been speaking to Elgin for a while about setting up a podcast interview, and we just missed each other at the True Crime Convention a couple of months ago, but we've been talking on Twitter, messaging about, and just as we were getting round to it, the Japanese former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was assassinated. And you may think, what's that got to do with the price of eggs? Well, it was allegedly done for a Moonie-related reason that I had no idea about, so I was fascinated to learn this from Elgin. And he'll divulge more and tell us about his own upbringing in the cult and how he left it. Of course, in today's episode, we only scratched the surface, so if you want to know more and hear from more voices, ex-Moonies, people who left the cult, do check out his amazing podcast, Falling Out. You'll get it in all the normal places. Coming up on this here podcast is the coffin confessor who reveals the secrets of the dead. He's back on. Prof Nutt, or Professor Nutt, who talks about psychedelics. Annie Ikpa on child sacrifices in Africa. And Benjamin Boyce on issues of woke academia at his old college. So a big bundle of different themes and topics and people. It's going to be great. But now, you're on the edge of the Moonies and the assassination of Shinzo Abe with Elgin Strait. Welcome to On the Edge with Andrew Gold. I finally got you on. We've been talking for a while. How are you doing, Elgin?
I'm doing all right. It's great to be here. And actually, before we start, can I just say, I've been a fan of your show for a while, I specifically remember listening to episodes 1 and 2, with Nate Phelps and Emily Green. And I just resonated a lot with what they said, for reasons that we can come to later on, but also with how you approach them as guests. And I just admire the way that you did that. So it's an honor to be here. And, as I've been doing this whole thing, which we'll come to talk about, I've been trying to, I guess, apply a little kind of like layer of filter to who I talk to. And you passed the test based on your track record, so congrats.
Oh, thank you. What lovely things to say. I don't know how to take the compliment. What do I do? I'm too British to take.
I can't take them either. But yeah, no, it's great to be here. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, those episodes, man, because a lot of people now got into the podcast just quite recently, and there's like 150 episodes in, and they don't know about the early ones. And that was the first ever one was the Westboro Baptist Church, as you say, Nate Phelps. And that was just like, I was so excited that he was going to come on. And then he did, and he was so cool, wasn't he? He's just great.
He's awesome. And I've actually, I connected with him afterwards and just said, hey, I really resonated with a lot of what you said. And he just had, like, there's just so much relevance between his experience and my experience. And we conceptually talked about him coming on my show. We've both agreed to it. It hasn't happened yet, but I would like to make that happen at some point.
Well, that's really nice. I hope you do. Yeah, because he's just wonderful and lovely. And then the next, Emily Green, man, I went to her house. I haven't met many people I've had on the podcast in real life, but I went to her house actually like a year before doing the podcast episode with her, because I was looking at doing something for like a documentary or whatever. And she's just so nice. And like, I think like, I don't know yet about all of your story, but I mean, in terms of a lot of other people who are people who are in cults, hers is really, I think the Hasidic Jewish one is really like, you know, you come out of that, you don't even speak English, a lot of them. I mean, she does, but with a bit of an accent. And it's just like, yeah, really, really out there, that one.
Yeah, it was quite extraordinary listening to that. And the bits that she was talking about arranged marriage, that is that happened to me, basically. So I resonated with that a lot. And again, we can talk about that. And I think it's interesting, all of these like high demand groups, they have different, each one has one thing that's like less bad than the other, but then they have another thing that's like way worse than the other. And I don't know, it's hard to pick which out of any particular group is worse than the other.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just listening to your podcast, you talk in one of the first episodes about, you know, rape, murder, suicide, neglect, abandonment. So we're going to have to demonetize this on YouTube, the YouTube version. They won't let me advertise after saying all those words in a row. But labor and child trafficking, children. I know it's going to be demonetized anyway. I'm just getting all those things out there. But I mean, horrible things. And you know, we'll get onto those. But because we've got a news tie-in, I'm really interested just to start with in obviously, you know, the Japanese former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was assassinated the other day.
Yeah.
So how does that tie in with the Moonies? Because that didn't even cross my mind at all.
Yeah. Well, and this actually goes back to what I opened this conversation with, which is like, all of a sudden people want to talk to ex-Moonies. And I've been banging this drum for the last year and a half about the abuses of this organization. And I feel like I've been screaming into a void with some people listening, but not many. And now all of a sudden, after Abe is assassinated, everyone wants to talk to me. Surprise, surprise. And I have to say, for the record, you and I were organizing this before the Abe assassination. And everyone else, I'm kind of like, where were you when I was doing that screaming, you know? So I guess the way it all ties in, and I guess this is what we talk a lot about this on my show, is that the Unification Church is effectively, I think calling it a religion is a misnomer, and I think that's an intentional misdirection on their part. It's more like a vast constellation of front groups that serve to bring money and power to the Moon family. And to give you a sense of the order of magnitude here, I found a list from 1980 that had over 1,400 front groups listed on it. And that wasn't all of them, and that was it in 1980. So over.
Wait, what's a front group?
So the classic example, okay, well, I'll give you a few examples. And the last one is going to be the one that ties in with Abe, although there are multiple. But some of them are ostensibly businesses. Probably the best example of that is a company called True World Foods, based in the US. It's the largest distributor of sushi in the US and also the largest in Europe. So if you eat sushi in either of those geographies, there's a 90% chance that it's coming through a Moonie run business. Those businesses are built on the backs of labor trafficked individuals, and we can talk about what that means, but these are people who are fundamentally coerced by the organization to work either for nothing or for way below market rates and in very poor conditions. That's how that business was built, on the backs of that, effectively, of labor trafficking. That's one of many front groups. The Moonies own the Washington Times, the newspaper in the US, which has become a font of misinformation and disinformation. I've spoken about that in other places. They owned, I don't know if they still own, a jewelry company called Christian Bernard. They own a recording studio in New York called Manhattan. It's the Manhattan Center Studios. They own a hotel called it's called the New Yorker Hotel. I used to live there when I was a kid. And then they own, and that's a drop in the bucket to start with. And then they own an ever-changing cast of effectively NGOs that they say are sort of working toward the goal of world peace. And so they have names like the Women's Federation for World Peace, the Universal Peace Federation, the International Media Association for Peace, the International Parliamentarians Association for Peace. And what all of these front groups do, especially those ones that have peace in their name, they host these conferences, and at those conferences, in general, they attract big name speakers by paying them money, and that money comes from people who are coerced. And in the case of the killer of Shinzo Abe, we can talk about Japan as a whole in a second. But basically, Japan is the money center of the Unification Church for a variety of reasons. But first of all, they're scamming non-church members at a very high level. There was a report from 1995 that they were getting about $300 million a year by scamming widows. And the way that scam works is by basically finding a widow who has recently suffered the loss of a husband in their family, usually. That person probably has a big life insurance policy. You knock on their door and you basically say, "Hey, I'm a spiritual medium. I can hear your husband's pleas for help in the spirit world. He's really suffering, and if you buy this little pagoda to put in your house for $100,000, you can stop his pleas." This is the sort of crap that they're doing to milk pensioners and widowers in Japan. And so there were reports in the 90s that they were making $300 million a year just from that scam. In the 90s, and these people aren't even the members. And then the church members are placed under an enormous amount of financial pressure. To give you a sense, in the West, all of our parents were coerced to giving away, at the very minimum to start with, 10% of their pre-tax income to the organization. In Japan, that's 30%. And that's pre-tax, right? So after tax, you're looking at probably half is gone to the organization right off the bat. And these are for people who are probably working for Moody-run businesses anyway, and doing so at below market and in horrible conditions to begin with. That's just the first layer of the coercion. But then they have other layers where every month there's a new providence that requires some sort of financial contribution. Could be $100, could be $1,000. And they also have what I consider to be modern day indulgences, which is a scheme where they basically say, "Hey, you as a living, breathing human vessel on the physical earth, you bear the responsibility for all the sins of your ancestors. And the way that you can alleviate them from the pain of all that sin is, surprise, surprise, by paying the Unification Church to remove that sin from them." And that is a grift that has no end, because they can start with, "Okay, this year you need to liberate 10 generations for $10,000. Okay, next year, guess what? The next 10 generations, due to the glorious providence of our true parent, Sun Myung Moon, we are now able to offer you the amazing opportunity to liberate the next 10 generations of ancestors. And guess what? That's going to cost you another 10 grand. And that well never runs dry, right? They can always, that always goes back. But then to bring it all back to Abe, so that's been going on in Japan and around the world for a long time. And what happens with that money is, number one, it goes into the pockets of the Moon family, and they live exorbitant lives. Number two, it goes to paying high-profile VIPs to speak at events hosted by one of these front groups. So groups like the Universal Peace Federation, the International Media Association for Peace, the International Parliamentarians for Peace. If you look at the websites for these places, they look like sort of quasi-UN NGOs. But if you dig into it, eventually they will usually kind of mention that it has something to do with with one of the members of the Moon family. And then you have these events where Shinzo Abe has spoken, Donald Trump has spoken, Mike Pence has spoken, Mike Pompeo has spoken. All of these people have spoken at these events. So they've taken money from the Moonies to speak at these events. They go and speak at those events. And then the Moonies go to their members and they say, hey, look, Shinzo Abe spoke at our event. This is further evidence that that people in the world are starting to understand, you know, the value of the work of the Moon family. So their mere presence at these places is furthering the cycle of abuse, and it's used as a further lever of coercion, effectively. So I completely understand the Abe killer's rationale, his motivation. Like Abe, like I understand why he was a target, because he spoke at those events. He was, you know, part of the system that exploited this guy's mother. So
is that what happened then?
Yeah.
It was his mother had been, lost money to the Moonies.
Yeah. So it was a guy who, I was born into the Moonies, but this guy wasn't. He was about my age. He wasn't born into the Moonies. His mother was a widower, I think around the age of 10. I don't know the exact timeline, but sometime when this guy was pretty young, his mother was recruited by the Unification Church to become a member. And gave them an incredible amount of money, and it bankrupt her. And so this guy, and I think there's an important kind of distinction here, is like this guy lived a life, he lived a life without the cult, and he kind of knew what that was like. And then it was taken away from him when his mother joined the cult. Whereas for me, I don't really have that reference point of like what a life looks like without the cult. But for him, he had that reference point, and it was taken away from him. And his mother was massively exploited by this organization. And I don't think he was wrong to put Abe to blame for some of that, quite honestly.
So could he just as easily have been Trump or Mike Pompeo or any of these other people who have spoken at?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All of those people bear the same type of guilt. I think there's some intricacies in Japanese politics that I don't know personally. But I understand. I think Abe's been like speaking at these things for a long time, and there's like other people, other politicians in Japan who are also speaking at them. I know that there's at least one current member of parliament in Japan who spoke at one of these events recently. And just to give you a sense, like there's a long list. I did a video on YouTube recently. I'd appreciate it if you could link it in the show notes that kind of outlines all of this. But it really dives into just the type of people that speak at these events. And so we're talking, I spend like probably 5 minutes just rattling off names on this video. And these are people who spoke at one event, and they've held, you know, hundreds or not that, if not thousands of these events over the decades. And people on that list include some people I've mentioned before. Other names that come to mind, Stephen Harper, the former prime minister of Canada, former president of Spain. Jose Manuel Barroso, this name comes up a lot, former prime minister of Portugal, former president of the European Council, current chairman at Goldman Sachs. These are all names. Dr. Sarah Gilbert, the creator of the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine. These are all people who have spoken at these events.
Do you think they're all aware of how destructive the cult is, or do they think it's no different to maybe going to a Church of England or Catholic sort of thing and speaking there?
I think it's possible that in the first time they do it, it's possible they don't know. It's possible they don't know. And there actually was a case in the 90s in Washington, D.C. So I grew up in the D.C. area, and Bill Cosby was invited to speak at one of these events. He signed a contract to come to the event, and he didn't know. My sense is that he genuinely didn't know what it was all about. But then once it got closer to the date, he figured out what it was, and he tried to pull out, but they wouldn't let him. And so eventually he did it, but he gave like a really shitty performance. Basically, he just like phoned it in because he didn't really want to have anything to do with it. So he kind of figured it out, but he couldn't pull out.
Bill Cosby. They shouldn't want to have anything to do with him either.
Yeah, but this was in 95, right? Or around 95. So this is before Bill Cosby was a different type of guy back then than he was now. So I do think sometimes they are genuinely duped. I think if they do it more than once, then they know what the deal is.
Yeah. Aren't Cosby's crimes quite historic, a lot of them anyway? So maybe he wasn't a different kind of guy, but he had a different kind of status back then.
He had a different status. His crimes are historic, but in 95, no one knew what they were in the way that they know now, basically.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Do you know, I mean, what do you, I think it's a really interesting one, Abbe, because he's just a face that I knew. I don't know much about international politics, particularly, you know, Far Eastern politics. I don't know anything. But I knew that face for years because he was just ruling for so long. What sort of, do you have an idea of sort of what sort of prime minister he was, what sort of person he was apart from the Mooney stuff, the speaking?
No, I haven't, politically, I don't know much about him at all. I've heard he is right wing. I've heard the word fascist thrown around, but I don't know. I don't know anything about Japanese politics, so I can't really offer anything there.
Well, let's move on from that and go into your story. You were, as you say, you were second generation. That means you were born into it. So your parents were sort of, would you, what's the word for it? Hoodwinked by it or tempted by it?
Recruited, coerced. Coerced, I would say. Coerced into joining it. Yeah. Yeah. So the primary method that they were using for recruitment in the 60s and 70s, which is when they recruited the most people, was the sort of classic cult recruitment technique. So first of all, they're recruiting people who are at a turning point in their life. A lot of times it's people on college campuses or people who've recently left university. And this is common across most cults. Most cults recruit people when they're at a vulnerable state in their life. And the way it works with the Moonies, as well as with many other cults, is someone will approach you, on campus or on the side of the road. It's usually a member of the opposite sex. So in 90% of these cases, it's someone from the opposite sex. And the reason is that there's a little bit of sort of sexual tension and sexual chemistry and energy that kind of puts your guard down. You know, if an attractive person of the opposite sex walks up to you and says, hey, you know, what's going on? Like, let's, you know, you would put your guard down, right? You would have that conversation, right? And they then invite you to what seems to be a pretty innocuous event, a barbecue or a picnic or a dinner, quasi dinner party at a house owned by the organization. And it'll be something like, you know, hey, we're going to have this dinner because we want to sit around and talk about world peace, or we want to talk about ending hunger or poverty. Are you interested in those topics? Would you like to come? And it's always like something that is virtually impossible to find fault with. It's some very airy-fairy, you know, big picture thing that would be really difficult for you to say, no, I don't care about world peace. So they end up, and some people end up saying yes. They go to this. They go to an event. Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a barbecue or a picnic or something like that. And you walk in, and so have you heard of the term love bombing?
Yes, but go on. Explain for those who
don't. Okay, I want to explain it, but can you tell me what you know of it first?
I interviewed Kelly Thiel, and she told me about, you know, going into Nixium, and it was this thing of just everybody telling her how wonderful she was and how happy they were for her to be there, and all that kind of thing. And it's just, my understanding of it is it often happens in cults at the sort of the beginning level. Just it doesn't so much later on, you know, as you go down the line, just to make you feel very special and sort of cut off ties from the rest of the world.
So that's exactly what happens with the Moonies. And the Moonies, I shit you not, they invented the term love bombing.
Oh.
In the 60s and the 70s, they created it. And it's exactly that. You walk into a room at one of these barbecues or picnics, and you don't know it, but you're the mark when you walk in, because all the members know who's a member and they know who's not the member. And you walk into that room and it's probably 80, 90% members and a handful of non-members. I don't know what it was like in Nexium, but that's what it was like in the Moonies. And when you're in that environment, everyone is showering you with love. They're telling you you're the greatest thing in the world. All of a sudden you're the funniest person. Everyone laughs at your jokes. You're the center of attention in a way that no one ever really is, unless you're like a rock star or something like that. Like it's an artificial sense of attention that is not really natural, and you wouldn't really have in other circumstances.
Wait, so are people then taught later to do that? Are they told like, okay, now we've got new people, do the love? So if they are taught that,
yes,
then they'll remember their first time. And isn't that the most embarrassing? That, to me, that's the most embarrassing thing I can imagine. Of like, hang on, when I came in and everyone was laughing at my jokes, they were doing it on purpose as a way to get me in. Oh, how embarrassing!
You'd think that would be the case, but what's happened in the meantime is the process has started with that. But eventually, and we can come into all the steps in a second. But eventually, you get to the point where you are taught, and you eventually believe that you have this special knowledge that no one else in the world does. And it's as a result of having that knowledge, it's your job to give other people that special knowledge, and the way to get them to understand that and to believe it in the way that you were brought to believe it is to bring them through that same process.
It's embarrassing.
So you'd hope it would be embarrassing, but that's what happens when you're in that coercive, when you've been coerced into believing it, then that is what happened. And I think, you know, I've spoken to some people who've left and were around in those days, and they express sort of, you know, deep regret in getting involved in it and bringing other people in after experiencing it themselves.
Yeah, a lot of guilt.
So that's, yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, that's the first step. And then from there, it continues to isolation. So they'll ask you to, you know, it goes from maybe a dinner or barbecue to, hey, why don't you come to this 2-day workshop we're having over the weekend? It's somewhere like in the country, away from the people you know and love. And back in the day, it's probably a little harder now with cell phones, but back in the day, you couldn't make phone calls. They would kind of stop you from having contact with the outside world, or it was very limited. A lot of times you had to like make calls in the presence of someone else, like your handler, basically. So all of a sudden, then you're isolated. The love bombing continues, but they also start like screwing with some of your other basic bodily functions. So you're sleeping less, you're eating poorly, and you're doing a lot of group activities. It sort of feels like adult summer camp in a way. But what's happening is that they're kind of whittling down your defenses, and starting to make you more and more dependent on feeling part of that group, so that when you leave, you kind of miss it. And then when they say, hey, oh, now we're having like a 10-day workshop, would you like to attend that, or a 20-day? Then you go, and that's when they really go in. When you go for like a week or two, sometimes three, that's when they really go for it. That's when they start sort of getting more intense in terms of the manipulation. You go through these so-called workshops where they start actually, and by the way, none of this up till now, at no point do they ever mention anything about Moon. you think you're part of, you know, this world peace organization, and then once they get you isolated for a long time, that's when they start layering in the theology, which eventually kind of ends with, oh, by the way, Reverend Moon is the Messiah, and would you like to join? But at that point, it's this process. It's actually not even that long of a process, but it's been sort of a gradual process of breaking you down, making you dependent on the group, wanting to feel that love, whittling down your connection to the outside world. And then some people say yes, and that's when they sign on.
So that's when they sign on. And then, so your parents signed on, you were brought into this world, and I've gotten a little bit into the mythology through your episodes, you know, that you were then, let's go into the mythology a little bit. And it's interesting what you're saying, because it is so similar to, like, you know, Scientology. No one hears about Lord Xenu until they're already so far in. Nixon was a similar thing. You don't hear about the horrible sex stuff you have to do until you're far in. So just a little, and I don't go too in depth, just because I'm a bit conscious of time, because we're sort of halfway through, but a bit of the purity stuff and the marriage stuff.
Okay, yeah, I think that's a big component of it, and it has a lot of similarities with other religions. Yeah, I mean, the foundation of the Unification Church is basically Moon claims that he received a revelation when he was 16 years old that told him that the fall of man, as we understand it in the Bible, was a sexual crime, effectively. So Eve, and there are two components. First of all, was Eve seduced the archangel. So Eve kind of slept with Lucifer. Lucifer became Satan as a result of that sexual act. And then Eve slept with Adam. As a result, they created this, and that was the original sin, basically. So the original sin was sex. And I, for context, I was told this when I was 4 years old. And most people in the cult were told at a very young age to have a very healthy relationship with sex and sexuality, starting with that. All sin and evil in the world started with sex. That's what it starts with. And then the theology goes on to state that the course of human history sort of worked its way up to Jesus being born, and Jesus's purpose was not to be crucified, but to have a family, and to therefore establish a sinless lineage on earth. But Jesus was crucified before that could happen, leaving his mission unfulfilled, leaving humanity to suffer for another 2,000 years until another Messiah could come to the earth and bring about a so-called pure blood lineage. Thus, enter Reverend Moon, who claims that he alone has the ability to give people this so-called pure blood lineage. And after he's done that, then their kids will be sinless, so-called blessed children. So I was technically, according to theology, I was born a sinless, so-called blessed child. And as a result of that, it's, according to them, my job to only procreate with another second generation that has been determined by the organization, effectively. And if I were to ever sleep with anyone else, then I would go to the pits of hell, because, like, literally go to a worse place than Hitler, because I would have sort of fallen from this position of having this, you know, unique pure blood lineage, and by throwing that away, then I'm like the worst person ever. Yeah.
Did part of you as a child growing up and hearing that, apart from all the mad stuff, you know, did part of you feel a bit special just from a young age? Like,
yeah, absolutely, yeah, completely. That's a big part of it. They make you feel special, yeah.
And did you feel special, and compared to your parents? Because I'm just trying to imagine it. I would almost maybe the germaphobe in me is sort of, I'd see them as like, I love you, mum and dad, but you're a little bit unpure, and I'm pure.
That was part of it. I think I don't think I ever necessarily felt that way directly towards my parents, but weirdly, there were some scenarios where it felt like the parents were almost like deferential to the kids, like, oh, they're blessed children. God will protect them. So maybe we don't need to do that much to protect them, because God is looking after them, because that they're, you know, they're so special. So weirdly, I almost feel like it went the other way. And I've spoken to someone who grew up in the cult, who told me that they saw a letter written by their mother, and the mother was basically saying, I don't think I can pick up my child because it's not my child. It's God's child.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That's the sort of, can I curse here?
Yeah.
I insist. That's the sort of shit. Yeah. That's the sort of shit that we were brought up with.
No sacred words on this channel, although okay, there is good. The demonetization good. Thing, but that's already, we're way beyond that anyway. And most people listen on Spotify and Apple and stuff anyway, where there is no demonetization issues with that. So you can say whatever the hell you want, as far as I know. I think that's fine. So tell me a little bit about your early years and things. What are the things that would stand out to people who've never heard of the Moonies or never been in a cult that were just like, what? Like, and that you thought were normal at the time?
Yeah, so I guess for me personally, looking at it from the outside, like I grew up in the suburbs in America, basically. Wouldn't have like really raised any eyebrows on the outside. But I mean, what was happening behind the scenes was every week we were waking up at 5 a.m. So we had an altar to Reverend Moon in our house. And actually, let me start. So when I was 8 days old, I was placed in front of this altar, and my parents wore these silk white robes, and they pledged my life to Moon and to his and to his family when I was just born, basically. And then every Sunday for as long as I can remember, we would wake up at 5 a.m., put on our suits and like our finest, and I stand in front of this altar of Moon and his family and do three full bows to them, and pledge our lives to them, literally pledging our blood, sweat, and tears, to achieve their so-called perfect world on earth.
Did you feel a strong emotion when you did that to about Reverend Moon?
Yeah, I did. To be quite honest. Yeah. We were taught. Yeah. Like this guy was the savior. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sounds bonkers now, and it is bonkers, but when you're taught from birth,
it is and it isn't, you know, because at that age I probably thought the same way about Santa Claus and things that I thought were real when I was 5 years old or 4 years old. I suppose the difference was that my parents didn't believe in Santa Claus at that age, at least as far as I know.
Yeah, I mean it's like it was that level of belief, I would say. And so that was like, so that was happening every Sunday for a long time. We would wake up every other day that wasn't a Sunday, maybe at like 6 or 7, and we would read the words of Reverend Moon. Sometimes we would do it in the evening. So every day we're reading the stuff. Then every Sunday we would go to church. I grew up in the DC area, and they have a big church. Actually, used to be owned by the Mormons in the DC area. And so I would go there, and then we had this sort of never-ending litany of weekend workshops, spring break workshops, summer camp workshops, where we would go and the indoctrination would continue in these places. And those would, again, like on the outside, they would probably look like some sort of standard sort of Christian, summer camp, but they weren't.
Hi, I'm Andrew Gold, former BBC journalist. I got a little tired of restrictions over who I could interview and what I could say and do, so I made this channel. Click this playlist here, and I'll be seeing you on the edge.
Going on 13, going on 14 for a year, so there were about 100 kids living there, 50 from the U.S. and Europe, and about 50 from Japan. We had 4 dorm parents, so it was like, it's been described as Lord of the Flies, and I think that's accurate. And one of the things we talk about a lot on my show is just the amount of negligence that happens in these environments. Kids have died in these sorts of places.
What?
Yeah.
Why? Just being left.
No one's looking after them. There's not enough supervision. There's this assumption that like kids are just gonna, they'll be fine because God is looking after them. And that actually ties into the other point, and I'll give you a specific example there. So, the church has this, youth program. They used to call it Special Task Force. Now they call it Generation Peace Academy. Ken going into the front group. So you can Google this right now, Generation Peace Academy. It's a Mooney front group. It's a new name for what used to be called Special Task Force, which was a youth program where you would send kids who had just graduated high school, so 17 or 18 years old. You send them out in groups living in vans for at least a year to go out and sell trinkets on the side of the road, to sell flowers in bars, just to sell anything, basically. They're called mobile fundraising teams. These are unsafe circumstances, and the organization just doesn't give a shit about these kids. So to give you one specific example of a death that occurred due to the negligence of the Unification Church in either 2001 or 2002, a girl who was either 17 or 18 years old was out on one of these fundraising trips. She was in a neighborhood somewhere, either in South Carolina or North Carolina. And so that give you a little context here, the church has this idea that, like, you know, it's your job to save people and convert them. And first of all, if they give you money, they're contributing to the providence, and it's going to be good for them in the spirit world. And second of all, if you can have a conversation with them that might open their eyes to maybe coming to a church event or something like that, then, you know, it's going to be good for them. And it's kind of your duty to give them that experience and to work towards giving them that experience. So it's quite common for these fundraisers to be invited into people's houses when they're knocking on doors. There was a girl, again, 17 or 18 years old, in 2001 or 2002, who was knocking on doors, and she ended up being raped and murdered. The killer was caught and is in jail now, as far as I know, but no one in the Unification Church ever suffered any consequences for that. Nothing at all. And this is still happening today. They were sending kids out doing this shit in the fucking COVID pandemic. I mean, it's a fucking heartless organization, quite honestly. And to give you a sense, we did a bit of back the envelope math on my show. We calculated that the average performer in one of these vans would pull in about $60,000 per year untaxed. And you have maybe eight people in a van, and that's the average performer. Some people could make as much as $3 million in a year, completely untaxed, going straight up into the Moon org.
And they don't see much of that in the end, do they?
These people see nothing. These people see nothing. And there are stories on my show of people ending up in the hospital, you know, from a car accident or a sickness or something like that on one of these things. And excuse my language, but the fucking Moonies will make them pay for the goddamn medical bill. That's how fucking heartless they are. Sorry, I'm getting worked up here and using a lot of language, but I feel quite strongly about this.
No, it's understandable. And at what point then in your childhood or adolescence or adult years did you start to question some of this?
Yeah, so I remember very distinctly, I was 18, and there was a book was written by a woman named Nonsa Kong. So she wrote a book called In the Shadow of the Moons. Nonsa Kong was the wife of one of Moon's sons, in fact, his oldest son, a guy named Hyojin. And in her book, she outlined how Hyojin was incredibly abusive physically, sexually. He was a raging cokehead throughout all this as well. She also detailed how Moon had an illegitimate child, and that was a real mind blower, because this is the guy who, to your question earlier, I was taught to worship, the guy who was setting the standard of morality. And the key standard of morality, according to him, was so-called sexual purity, one man, one wife forever. And then to hear that he had a kid outside of marriage, that was really, I was like, wait, what? And actually, to give you a sense of what that feels like, at first I didn't believe it. I didn't think it was real. I thought it was just his detractors were making things up. And the church intentionally wants you to think that. They tell you, they try to inoculate you against that by saying, oh, any critics are just, you know, they're haters, they're detractors, it's Satan who's speaking through them. So that's what I was taught to believe. And that's what I thought to begin with. But then I actually talked to someone who was in the know in the church, who was like, okay, sit down, sit down. I got to tell you something. It's true, but you got to understand why. And then they went through this long, long convoluted explanation, which was basically like, God's providence really needed Moon to have a son. And therefore, and his first kid was a daughter, and therefore he really had to just like make sure he had a son. And that's why he had this kid outside of wedlock. And I just thought, yeah, bullshit. When I read that and I was like, are you kidding me? Like, if you can justify that, you can justify anything. And that for me, that was like, no, this is wrong. That was the real like penny drop moment for me.
Okay. And then the thought of leaving, because presumably your parents were still, you know, card carrying members, you know, and what leaving means with any cult means leaving everything behind, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, for me, like, I was fortunate enough to go to a public school. So I had some friends outside of school. I went to normal university as well, which is great. Again, had like, you know, kind of normal friends and decent job prospects, like outside of the cult. But still 90% of my community was from the cult, and my parents were from the cult, and all of my parents' expectations for me were completely built on me continuing this so-called pure blood lineage. That's a lot of pressure, quite honestly, to put on someone. And so as a result, even though I left, it kind of left mentally when I was around 18, a few years later, due to all of that tremendous pressure, I accepted an arranged marriage to someone from the cult who was also in a similar boat to me. They had left mentally, but they still felt all of that pressure. So they weren't really a member, but they felt all the pressures. And our parents coincidentally suggested us to each other, and we kind of looked at each other and we're like, hey, maybe we could make this work. And, you know, and so we decided to do it. And yeah, I got married at a pretty young age to someone as a result of the cult. We were together for about 14 or 15 years. About 4 years ago, we split up. And I think in the wake of that split up, I feel like after that, that's when I really left the cult, because for the first time, I could actually look at things completely dispassionately and independently, because my relationship, my marriage was still built on the cult. Like, the very idea of us being together was, you know, built on the foundation of the cult. And then finally, without that, I could then really kind of try to examine what had happened to my life and to my family.
Did you have good times with your ex-wife? They say that arranged marriages, sometimes people are happier on average, and I don't mean to belittle or be glib about, you know, the horrible stuff behind why there are arranged marriages, but were there nice times?
Yeah, there were some great times, and we're still very good friends now, and we share a son, we co-parent very amicably now. Yeah, it wasn't all bad. Absolutely, it wasn't all bad. And I know sometimes they can be all bad, for sure. To your point earlier, right? It wasn't all bad. Absolutely not.
And leaving then, I mean, so what was your relationship like with your parents beforehand, before leaving? Because when we hear these stories, of course, we've got an hour here, right? So we only get like a little glimpse, and we always imagine just everything being about the cult. But were you also like, hey, Dad, do you want to go and watch the football or the whatever? Or were they just chatting about other stuff? Or was everything based around the Moonies?
With my dad, almost everything was about the Moonies. Like super duper serious.
Super Moonies.
Like, yeah. Super Moony. And I like, yeah, like, we would never go to the football, like, never. It was always, and he was also always working. So he worked for one of the Moonie businesses, working long hours, 5 days a week through the week. Often on Saturdays, he was working for them. On Sundays, we would go to church. And sometimes after Sundays on church, he would go to the office to keep working for them. So he was working a lot. And I've actually told someone, I've told this, I forget who I was telling this to, but I'm divorced, and I have a kid, and my kid has been on more holidays with both of his parents in the COVID pandemic than I ever went on with both of my parents as a kid. just because they were like, my dad was always working. Like, I did some stuff with my mom. I think like my mom would try, like, she would take us to the cinema, and I think it was a bit more kind of normal, I would say, my relationship with my mom. But with my dad, it just felt very, very influenced by the church, I would say.
I'm imagining a stern man. I'm making assumptions here, but stern, yeah, and serious.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Conservative, yeah, sort of old-fashioned, serious, religious. And you don't seem like that at all. So you must have felt at times like, you know, how are we related? You know, I think a lot of people feel that often with parents.
Yeah. My ex-wife still tells me, she's like, I can't believe you're related. so, yeah, I think you're, yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
And then how did the conversation go about, listen, this your entire life, mum and dad, I think it's nonsense, and so I'm leaving?
It's a good question. It was basically like, well, I can see why you might say that, but you're not seeing it from God's point of view. And that, to me, that's always like this is what kills me about talking to people that have beliefs like this, is like if your belief is based on, you know, seeing things from God's point of view or seeing things from X point of view, you're pretty much impervious to any sort of outside reasoning at that point. You've coated yourself with Teflon intellectually, and nothing's going to stick. No matter how much I say, like, unless you are willing to fundamentally revisit that principle about how you view the world, then I'm not going to be able to change anything about the way you view the world. So unfortunately, that's kind of the reality, of their worldview.
Do you still speak to them or see them, or is there like a shunning thing?
It's not shunning. But I have more or less intentionally, tried to keep the contact to a minimum. And I have to say, in case they ever listen to this, I would say, like, my mom is making an effort. And my dad doesn't, I don't really think is, my dad, I think, is still in the church. My mom says she's out. But it's to give you some she says she's out. But when your entire relationship with someone from birth has been all tied up in all of these concepts, literally every conversation I have with her has some reference to the Moonies or some way of Moonie thinking. And I'm like, Mom, I can't, this is not helpful for me. Like, you need to do the work to get this out of your head, but I can't do that for you. So, like, let's talk once you've done that. And I think she's made some strides in that way, but it's still very difficult for me to talk to them when they still have these concepts. I mean, just the concept of second generation is still a concept that they adhere to.
That you're pure.
That I was pure, but I'm not anymore. Imagine adhering to that concept in any capacity, that your son is now worse than Hitler, according to the theology of the movement.
Is it like you'll be having a conversation with her and then she might very subtly get in that you're worse than Hitler?
No. So here's the, she won't say that. And I've actually challenged her on that. And she's like, oh no, I don't think that at all. But she'll still use words like second generation. And I tell her, like, Mom, like, that's a completely fabricated concept. Like, and this is what it means to me. When you say that, it brings back all of these memories. We've kind of gone through this process of me, like, of multiple instances of that, just with different terms. And like, if that happens like 4 or 5 times, then you have to, for me, I was like, Mom, I just can't talk to you, because every time I talk to you, you say something, and it's just evident that the vocabulary of this institution is just part of the fabric of your life and your existence. So like, and that's not something that I want to be part of my life now.
It's hard though. I the devil's advocate in me is I feel sorry for her, I suppose, because sometimes, you know, you get so invested in something that your world shrinks and then all you have is that. And then there's the religious side and then there's the cultural side as well. So there's the beliefs. Yeah. And then I'm just thinking of my own family with this sort of, there's a lot of the Jewish stuff from when I was younger and having to, and I react exactly how you do to a lot of it. But part of me, as I get older, I'm trying to be more accepting that it's just different worlds, different lives, and I just think a different way to how that it's out of some people in that community, you know, the community I grew up in, it's out of their worldview. They can't even get to, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I know. And I think it's really hard, like when, so I think like one of the other things that's happening here is I talked to, one of the guests on my show, which maybe we should talk about towards the end here, but basically one of the guests on my show basically told me that she felt that she was a quote ticket to heaven for her parents, and this is actually how I think all of our parents viewed us. Like the church basically told them that they need to have kids so that they can create this lineage which will allow them to go to heaven. So when you feel like you're pure, simply a means to an end for your parents to achieve this spiritual, you know, success or whatever, like, I don't know. It's hard to think like, actually I want to invest a lot in this when you know that was the purpose of your conception.
Do you feel like a commodity?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, we 100% we were commodities. And that person who used that quote, a ticket to heaven, to give you a sense of the way that we were commodities, she is what was called an offering child, and what this is common in the Unification Church. So there's this idea that you have to have so-called second generation kids to go to heaven, right? So then, what do you do if you're a couple and you can't conceive? You still want to go to heaven, right? So what the church will do is it will coerce another member to have a kid and give it to you so that you can go to heaven. And this is what the woman who used that quote, I feel like a ticket to heaven, used that because she's the ultimate example of a commodity, of kids being commodities in the Unification Church. I mean, that's a more extreme case than mine, but I still feel that I resonate with that strongly. And I think most people who grew up in the cult would say the same thing.
Yeah. It's really evocative. And I think it's really visceral because I think we can all relate to it on a very small level. We've all at one moment or another in our darkest moments and thoughts had a little feeling of like, am I just here to show off to something or for some reason? And nowhere near on the same stage as what you're talking about. But I think we can maybe imagine how that might feel. And that's, I mean, again, it's not the same level at all, but my mum used to want us to go to synagogue with her only a few times a year, but I just outright refused. And I was like a spoiled child going, no, I'm not going. And I had the feeling of it was very important to be shown. It wasn't important for my parents to go to my dad as well. My dad, maybe even more so actually, that the community see that the children were there, and if not, there was some sort of, and that's more of a cultural thing than even a belief system. But so I had a very tiny version of that and didn't like how that felt. So I can imagine that. Do you struggle with that even today? Do you feel at all, you know, do you have to remind yourself, I'm not a commodity. I'm not here to help somebody get to heaven. I'm my own person.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. I'm still trying to figure out all of the psychological ramifications of growing up in that environment, and I don't think I figured it all out yet, quite honestly. I think it feels like it's kind of a never-ending process where you've kind of uncovered one thing and then you take a bit more time and you uncover something else. It's really, I don't think I'm ever going to reach the end of that process. And most of the people on my show, I think we kind of say like, this is a long-term game to figure this out.
I think when I speak to people who've been in cults, I always want to say to them that although it is much harder and stuff, of course, because of the cult upbringing, that it must be even harder because most people, I think, pretend that they've got all of their shit figured out. So you'll never know, like, hang on, but is this normal, like, baggage that, or is this a cult baggage? So I sort of want you to know that a lot of people are pretending as well who haven't been in cults. Like, they may not have been through the same experiences. I don't mean to undermine what you've been through.
No, I understand.
You know what I mean? Like, they've got shit going on. Like, human minds fucked. So
yeah, I agree. Yeah. I agree. Yeah, I agree.
But there's, I mean, one of the things you mentioned in the podcast, in your podcast, is what was it? It was learning, you know, from a young age that sex is the worst thing ever in the world, and then when you're supposed to procreate, suddenly switch it on like that. That's got to leave a lasting legacy. No, I mean, you don't have to speak about your own experience, but people in general from the Moonies.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, I think let me talk about some of the meta themes that I've seen on my show that have emanated from that. So one of the things, I think a lot of us in general, like, relationships are difficult to navigate, I would say. And we're, a lot of it's like just knowing how to, like, hold your own, or knowing that you have your own worth in a relationship, because you're basically told. So to give you a sense of the background here, I was told as a kid that, like, it was my job, the most important thing that I did in my whole life was to accept whoever the church told me I should marry. And so we went through these exercises in some of these indoctrination camps that I mentioned. We went through these exercises where we were taught to, or we were told to, envision the person that we liked the least, the ugliest, the meanest, the person that we just didn't want to, like, the person you would never want to be with, and just accept that you had to be married to them. And so that was what we were taught from a very young age. And then, you know, so then you enter into a relationship, and at least, like, my marriage, I think probably one of the biggest flaws in my marriage is that, like, neither of us felt like we could really kind of, like, we couldn't really hold our own. We had we always had to compromise on everything, because conflict wasn't, like, just, we were never taught to navigate conflict, and we were taught to just always accept that, like, you need to bend over for the other person. You need to make room for them. And, like, sometimes there are just core incompatibilities. This is why people date before they get married, to figure this out. But they're, like, I don't know. We were just never taught that our needs were worth anything in the relationship. Anything that we needed just had to be, you know, put on the back burner and for whatever the other person needed. So I guess that's a starting point in terms of what we were taught. And then what that's meant in terms of some of the other themes that I've seen on my show is, and this is really sad, is that, you know, one of the meta themes, and yeah, this is a meta theme now, it's not a singular instance, it's a meta theme now across my show, is, it's more with women than with men, is, women basically, when they leave the cult, they don't have a sense of sexual agency. And they feel like they just have to do whatever the man wants, basically. They don't feel like they can say no effectively, because they were never taught that they could say no. And as a result, unfortunately, multiple people on my show have told me that they have, you know, been raped, basically, because they didn't know that they could say no. And yeah, that's absolutely a thing.
I imagine, does that extend beyond the sexual to just, you know, that feeling? I think, you know, we all have that to an extent as well, of like, what do I want? What am I going to do in my life? And you're suddenly in a position, having been in a cult or been in a repressive society where you're told what to do all the time. Now, suddenly you've got agency and you don't know how to, do I want things? Is there any of that going on?
Yeah, absolutely. Completely. I still feel like I'm, you know, I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing with my life, quite honestly. To your point earlier, I suspect many people also feel like that for most of their life. But I feel like, okay, I don't really think the be all and end all of my life is not necessarily being married and having kids. I've been married once. I have a kid. I don't think I want to do either of those things again, to be quite honest. Certainly not in the short term. Okay, with those out of the picture, then what? I don't know, quite honestly. It's interesting, but it's also daunting. And I don't really, I feel like, yeah, maybe people have a better way to navigate that. How do you navigate that? Let me, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, the reason I'm thinking of it is because it's something I've always struggled with myself. I feel, you know, that I grew up, I do think sort of, it's hard because I don't want to give too much away that, you know, for people who could be hurt by that. But just, I went to a very, very sort of disciplinarian school, I think, which was a good school. I'm very happy I went there and all that. But high school, I mean. Oh, you live in the UK, don't you? So school means high school. Secondary school.
I get it, yeah.
But just that feeling of like, what am I doing wrong? So you end up, and I think a lot of people have this, and I'm sure a lot of listeners will relate to this. You end up so sort of hyper aware of your own movements and your speech and things in case other people might be upset by them. You don't have much space to think like, what do I want to do? So I see a cult or any kind of restrictive society as an extension or an exaggeration of that under some sort of watchful eye. And then you do get to an age, and again, I'm sure loads of people listening can empathize with this. It's probably like a certain percentage, like 20% of people or 30%. And you get to an age where you're an adult and you're free and you're like, okay, but what do I want? And no matter how much you push yourself, like, you know, I want to do what I want, when you're with people, you probably give away, you give off like a supplicated or a submissive air that you don't mean to. And then depending on the dynamics of those people, they might then sort of take control a bit more. And then you end up afterwards going like, oh, I wish I had sort of more oomph like that. So yeah, it's really difficult. It's really, no one knows what to do. We're all just distracting ourselves till we die anyway.
No, that's interesting. And the one thing I have to say is that, I was separated at 36, now divorced because it takes a while, obviously. And I guess I had my kid when I was 32, 33. And now I'm on the other side of that. So my son's 8 years old now. But the good news for me is there are a lot of people my age who might be thinking like, okay, now's when I got to buckle down. I got to get serious. I got to get married. I got to have a kid. They're feeling all of those pressures that I know exist out there in the world. But I'm like, well, look, I've already done that. been there, done that. Like I can decide whether or not I want to do it based on having done it. I can decide if I want to do it again based on having already done it. But I'm not making that decision in a vacuum anymore since I've already been through it. And I'm also not feeling any pressure because I've already crossed that bridge. So bizarrely, I'm kind of feeling like quite free at the moment because I'm not feeling any of that pressure. So it's actually kind of a good place to be, I think.
Given where you come from, that's fantastic to feel free. Tell people where you'd like them to go and check out, you know, your podcast or in your Twitter and all that. I'll do an intro and outro as well on the audio podcast, but yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, just for context, so I host a podcast called Falling Out, which is basically me talking to other people who grew up in the same cult as me. You can find that at fallingoutpod.com on all the podcast platforms. Excuse me. Look for Falling Out. I'm also on Twitter at Falling Out Pod and Instagram at Falling Out Pod. I'm quite active on Twitter at the moment with everything happening with Abe. So it's a good place to follow just kind of stuff that's not covered on the show. I also have to say, like, the show that I do, I really try and focus on the stories of the people that I have on. So it's less about all this other stuff. It's less about Abe than it is about the guests that I have. Although I will try to address that, and it is of great interest to me. But Twitter tends to be a place where I tend to just tweet about some of that other stuff that just doesn't make it into the show, quite honestly.
Yeah, it's a great podcast. I'd recommend people checking it out. That's, you know, Falling Out podcast, and you do balance the sort of the political ideological sides with the personal human stories really well. So yeah, please everyone do support our guest and check that out. Thank you, Elgin, so much for coming on The Edge with me. It was great having you.
No worries, my pleasure. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Thank you so much, Elgin, for coming on The Edge. What a lovely, charismatic and fascinating man he is. You are, whoever, if I'm speaking to him or if I'm speaking to you listeners, it depends, doesn't it? It's a fascinating person regardless. Do send some much deserved love his way by checking out his podcast, Falling Out, in all the normal places. Personally, I found it fascinating to learn all about this marriage and children-centered cult, and hope, I really do hope, that more leavers like Elgin feel emboldened to speak out after hearing him talk so bravely and openly. Do please keep reviewing the podcast on Apple and Castbox, and even more importantly, tell a couple of friends about this podcast so it can soar like an eagle into the sky. That's all for today, and as my listener Daz H suggested, I start saying, you may now step away from The Edge. The problem with that is I want people to stay on The Edge to listen to more episodes. So maybe that doesn't work, but it's a good suggestion, really. So thank you for that, Daz. And to all of you, have a wonderful day, evening, whatever it might be, wherever you may be.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.